session number 11191, Reel 4.
Len Pearman, Reel 4.
It is the 3rd of February. We began our march again at 9 a.m. with another crowd from another prison camp which had joined us in some way. I've forgotten her. Which had also spent the night in barns roundabout. We marched a considerable distance until we reached a place called Spremberg, and we stayed in some army barracks until about 3 p.m. and then we marched another, I think it was about 10 or 15 kilometers to the west, to a station where we file into cattle trucks at 50 men to a truck. Fairly good. We're reasonably warm and we slept well. On Sunday the 4th of February, the following day, we arrived at Luckenwalde, which is situated about 12 miles south of Berlin, at about 7 p.m. And we march 4 kilometers to the camp. We spend the night waiting, the entire night, waiting our turn for delousing and showers. And we reach and are led into the barracks at 7 a.m. The barracks are brick buildings with fairly large, with lots and lots of three-tier bunks, which had been occupied by prisoners of war of some kind, I don't know which, but they'd been cleared for us. And these were terrible places. It was a most depressing sight to see the inside of one of these barracks with their three-tier bunks, and we were housed 250 men to a bunk. And after this, it becomes a bit difficult, because our food now was not even the normal German rations. Which was really the pits, as they say, because the Germans had little food. The Russians were advancing all the time, and the means of Red Cross parcels, of getting Red Cross parcels, there weren't any. Some came after 4 or 5 weeks there, but for a time we had to live on the German rations, which were not really enough to support life, and many of us couldn't get off our bunks. Ankles began to swell. Beriberi was on the way, and it really was the worst time of our captivity. Luckenwalde was a terrible time. And eventually, unfortunately I haven't got it, but eventually we were able to survive in a way, and because of the good men that they were, their spirits didn't flag. The Germans were in a terrible condition also, and although they still insisted they were going to win the war with their secret weapons, it looked pretty hopeless. And we were advancing all the time. The Russians were advancing at an enormous rate. And then one morning, suddenly the Germans had disappeared in the night. But Robert Key has discovered that at this very time, Hitler had issued an order that we should all be shot. He had, from his bunker, issued an order that all RAF prisoners should be shot, because it was holding up, we were holding up the Wehrmacht. But it wasn't carried out, thank heavens. That's in retrospect. We we were suddenly faced with an unguarded camp. No Germans, but the guns were well within earshot. We knew that the battle was very, very close, and the German officer in charge of the nearest company of the Wehrmacht had issued orders that any prisoner found wandering about outside the camp would be shot. So, and we had received orders over our secret radio that we were to stay in the camps. It was too dangerous for us to move out, and so it turned out to be. That afternoon, into the camp comes a little armored car with a red star on it. Marvelous. Marvelous. The Red Army had arrived. So you can see how we feel about the Red Army. And while we were making a fuss of this little Mongol chap, the shooting started up again, and he had to disappear. But eventually, the same night, the Russian tanks came and started to pull the wire down with their guns and invite us to go up to Berlin with them. 18-year-old girls were on the tanks with Tommy guns. Come on to Berlin, come on. They were marvellous, the frontline troops. And then, following them, came the artillery. And it was very impressive to see the Russian place their artillery not far away from us, at very close intervals. And they began to pound Berlin, or the retreating German army, into submission.
Were you impressed with the Russians?
Oh, yes.
It sounded as if you were.
Absolutely. Oh, they were. They were great. Look, they were like us. They were on our side. We had hopes of living and getting home again through them.
Did they strike you as being a disciplined force?
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, there's no question about that. They were not so disciplined as the Germans. The Germans were very impressive. But the Russians were very much in control of themselves. And there was some difficulty in the local town. The Russians didn't mess about, but then the Germans messed about even less. They'd murder 100 men because of one of theirs might have been hurt. They gave the gas, the water and the electricity had been cut off from Luckenwalde, which was a few miles away. And the Russians took the town over, of course, and they appointed mayors. They appointed one of the elder statesmen of the town, and they'd make him the mayor. They'd give him 6 hours to get the water and the electricity put on. And if it wasn't on in 6 hours, he'd be shot. Then they'd appoint another one. By the time the third, and give each one 6 hours, the third mayor got it on. So they didn't mess about. And we walked out occasionally and saw them cleaning out the houses of any men that they could find in the houses. They didn't touch the women. But Russian soldiers were in and out of each house. Occasionally they'd find a German, and out he'd come into a prison camp. We saw we were very fond of one or two Germans, and we saw them, people who were not unkind. We saw one of them, an old man, about 50, sitting on a tank, a Russian tank, with a couple either side, and a girl was holding a bayonet up to his throat, asking us if she should cut his throat now or later. And we said, don't hurt him.
That would have been a girl in the Russian army, would it?
Yes, oh yes.
Were there many women?
Oh yes, quite a lot. There was on tanks, with Tommy guns strapped to them, in the front line. We didn't have that. Anyway, all this passed, and eventually we established a relationship with them. We had some good Germans, Russian speakers with us. Robert Key was trying to learn Russian, and he became an interpreter, but we had several others. And we got some kind of order. I mean, their idea of food was not ours. If you want some meat, they round up, did I tell you on the phone? They round up half a dozen cows. There you are. Everything belongs to the Red Army. You want some cows? You've got a butcher? Get to work. You want some bread? Out we'd go in about 4 or 5 trucks, round up the contents of a bakery and take their output for 3 or 4 days. All the bread we wanted. What more do you want? Groceries? Everything belongs to the Red Army. The Germans took second place. Ah, well. And this continued until eventually, suddenly, these American trucks are outside. About, I can't remember how many, but enough to take us. And the American officer came in, had a coffee with us. By this time, we were setting up home. My navigator and I and 3 or 4 others were living in one of the guards' houses on the camp. It wasn't bad. We used their beds, and it was all right. So we took this American officer in and gave him all the hospitality that we could summon, which was reasonable coffee and so on. And we began to... he said, I've come to take you home. Come on, pile into the trucks. Off we go. And quite a lot of the boys began to climb into the trucks, and the Russians lined up either side with Tommy guns and ordered us all out. And the Americans were given 5 minutes to get on their way and get back to the Elbe. Well, the Americans stopped. And then we, of course, we were disgusted by this and taxed the... Russian colonel with it, and he explained about Yalta.
What did he say?
I'm very sorry. I know how you feel, but I'm not allowed to let you go until the Yalta agreement has been fulfilled. The Yalta agreement? We said, what's that? And he explained. He said, we must make the best of it.
What did he explain? Did he explicitly mention...
Their prisoners must be returned to the Red Army, which was agreed by Stalin, Churchill and Roosevelt, for good or ill. But that was the agreement. And so we had to make the best of it until the agreement was complete. In the meantime, they would observe the protocol, and would be expected to behave in a reasonable way. We don't want trouble, he said. But if we have trouble, we know how to deal with it. A veiled threat, which was never carried out. But we had a less... we were watched so that we didn't escape. One or two did. One or two started to walk down the railway track. Francis Clayton, I remember. I've never heard of him since. He might be all right, but he disappeared. And they went down the railway track and westwards on their own. In individual groups. But the Russians were very careful that we stayed where we were, and we stayed for many weeks. And this is the trouble. I can't remember the exact date that it took place, but suddenly another column of trucks lined up, all with Russian drivers, and in we got. We were told to get in, and we're going home. We're taking you to the Elbe. All is well. We had a Russian officer and a driver in ours, and I remember making a funny remark. I said, don't let them, to my friends, I said, don't let them fool you. We're not going to the Elbe, we're going to Siberia. And this officer turned around, made me feel so humble, in perfect English. He said, oh, no, no, you're not going to Siberia. you're going home to England. You will see.
Were you able to ask anyone, you know, or were you even interested in the sort of details of the Yalta Agreement, you know, whether the Soviets had
not at that time. Not at that time. We were vaguely aware of it.
When did the significance of that come to you, do you think, you know, the actual...
Well, it was afterwards, you see. I think afterwards, a long time afterwards, when we realised that this agreement had been made. I think some of us may have got it on the news, I'm not sure. I certainly hadn't... It hadn't impacted on my mind. It hadn't come through to my mind that there had been this special Yalta agreement. And the first I heard of it really was when it was explained by the Russians that they had to observe it. And there we are. We got into the trucks and we were driven to the Americans. The Americans took us to Leipzig. They shoved us into Dakotas, flew us to Brussels, and then the RAF took us in Lancasters to Bicester, and we were home.
That must have taken a bit of readjustment as well, did it?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
After, what was it?
Three years. Some were four. Yes, that was, so there you are.
Now, how quickly did you adjust to the situation?
After coming back?
Yes.
Oh, immediately. No trouble at all. I was reasonably fit, and my then wife was there, and two children, and we adjusted. I had to stay in the RAF for another month or so, or two or three, and I went back to the company that I was working with before the war, the Mitchell & Tyre Company, of which I became sales manager. And it was reasonably okay. It took me perhaps 3 or 4 weeks, but there was no hardship time. I began work very quickly, and all was forgotten.
Do you think, you know, when you look back at your war, and particularly the imprisonment, did you gain anything from that?
Yes.
You sort of indicated one or two things.
Oh, it was the richest time of my life. I'd been married since I was 21. I had been imprisoned in marriage and work. But here I was, after the year of adjustment. I was free to read what I liked, do what I liked, and paint, which I'd always wanted to do, and began to paint rather seriously. But as seriously as conditions would allow. And then I took up painting again at weekends, and began to paint portraits, and then I retired from my company when I was about 59, 58. They were very, very good. I had a very happy time with them. And I began painting very seriously there. And I began painting wildlife. And I work up there in the studio. It's a wooden studio. It's a hut, but it's got air conditioning and light in the north. And so and I've had a pleasant retirement. But not really a retirement, because I'm busier now than I've ever been.
Yes, this recent publicity, you know, about the Cossacks, which really concerned you. I mean, these were the people who Stalin was insisting had to be returned before, presumably, you were going to be allowed to be released. Is that right?
Correct.
Yes. So I wonder how you, when you read about it now, the details, how you react.
We get the red mist. We get the red mist. All of us do. We we get very angry that 87,000... We were the infantry of the Second World War. 87,000 bomber crew were killed. There were 87,000 of us, 8,000 of us prisoners. 10% of us became prisoners. But 87,000 was the figure. Bomber command alone died or were taken prisoner. Are they saying that we didn't do enough to justify our release? Should we then have been sent to Siberia and sat on while whatever was done with these Cossacks was done? What would they do with them? Now we're leaving my history. Had we had few thousand, say, they didn't fire, there wasn't one, but suppose there were about 8,000 or 9,000 British who had fought for the Germans against the Russians. And the Russians caught them. What should they have done with them? But there weren't any. We were given the opportunity to fight for the Luftwaffe. Oh yes, the invitation was made. You'll have a lovely life. You don't have to fly if you don't want to. Come and join us. Come and work for us against the Russians. Well, they're the enemy of both of us. Come and help us. Two or three times this invitation was made. Not a single one took it up. But how would you feel about, well, you can imagine how we would feel. And I mentioned Lord Haw-Haw to you on the phone, I remember. He was only speaking in a microphone. He was a source of wonder and merriment to us. He used to amuse us day after day with his reporting of the clock in Bury St. Edmunds being 4 minutes late. And it was all very good stuff. But what did we do with him? We hanged him. And all he did was speak in a microphone. The Cossacks, on the other hand, were actually fighting the Eighth Army in Italy and causing a great deal of delay in bringing the war to an end. They were fighting against their own country.
I think the people who sort of defend Count Tolstoy, you know, and his writings, mention the fact that a lot of these people were émigrés who left in 17, who didn't like the Soviet Union, or were women and children. You know, that is the argument.
Mm, I know.
But would you still go along with the fact that, you know...
Too bad. Too bad. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for them. And I know it's tragic that this thing happened to them. But we can have people like me, I suppose, can find very little sympathy for people who are fighting against their own country. We would have felt very unkind towards people who had fought against us, who were enlisted in the British Army. It's a long time ago now. But Judge Davis said, the most difficult thing for us in this court is to imagine what it was like in 1945. I mean, if it were 1960 or 1970 and there were 180,000 Russians who didn't like Stalinism, maybe, then, of course, we could sympathize with them and find places. But not at that time. Not when so many of our own people had been killed, stopping Hitler, who we then knew and now know was one of the most evil things that the world has ever seen. Auschwitz, Dachau, Buchenwalder. I know that the white Russians probably knew nothing about Auschwitz. They were innocent of that. all they were concerned about was to have a go at re-establishing the Romanovs, which they're still doing. And we had no sympathy for such ambitions. Our job was to beat Hitler, and it was a near thing.
Yes, I think it's interesting also the fact that you had first-hand experience of your ally, the Red Army.
Oh, yes.
And you obviously...
Very
did
impressed.
You feel that, you know, you were allies?
Absolutely. That little Mongol face that came out of the armoured car was smothered with kisses. We loved him. It's the first ray of real hope that we've seen for years.
And was there a real fear in the camp, you know, after the lorries had been, the first lorries had been returned, that if these Russians, yes, the Cossacks, were not returned to Stalin, you would be there forevermore?
Well, we wouldn't be there, but we would certainly be in Russia. Oh, yes, we felt, many of us felt this, many of us didn't, but many of us felt that it would be a very dismal outlook for us if the terms of the Yalta Agreement were not carried out.
I think the British POWs were given by people like Eden and James Dean and Brimelow as one of the reasons.
Yes, Grigg was the War Office Minister of State, and he said very clearly that if it's a question between how many thousands Cossacks and Yugoslavs and our own prisoners of war, there can be only one answer. This is what Grigg said. Grigg issued orders to Field Marshal Alexander. Field Marshal Alexander issued orders to General Keatley. General Keatley issued orders to Lord Orling, to Toby Lowe. And they had to go back. Aldington was merely an officer in the line of command. He had to do it, good or ill. And it emanated from Grigg, probably also from Churchill and Macmillan, as we know. But you read The Minister and the Massacres. I haven't read any of that.
What did you think of the outcome of the trial?
Oh, when I came home that afternoon, and June rushed out, and she said, "It's $1.5 million. I said, "What? Damages?" Of course, it's an unreasonable amount, but I was overjoyed. At the outset of this thing, I said, "Lynn, and forgive me if your sympathies are elsewhere," I said, "I hope this man Tolstoy and Watts are ruined financially, and it's come about, or will come about, after the appeal that Tolstoy has put out now. I'm sure he's very nice. I like the look of him, and I like the look of Watts, and his Watts was most chivalrous to me. Aldington, on the other hand, is the kind of face of a man that we require in war, who can make decisions and can be hard. And thank God for him."
Well, Len, thank you very much.
Oh, good.
For telling me, you know, your very interesting experiences and your thoughts about this. Thank you.
Well, it's been a pleasure to meet you. And thank you for listening.